Hey, welcome to the Meat House, and thanks for listening to episode 221. I'm Jeff. Joining me tonight is our winner of the 2021 Iron Bee, Kyle Ducharme. He and I are going to talk about his entry and the competition. Then we'll discuss what he's been up to since the competition was going on 5-6 months ago. Hey, thank you for listening to the Meat House podcast. You can find us everywhere. We're on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Amazon Music. The whole list is available on our website, www.themeathouse.com. You can check it out there for the whole list. And hey, before we get to that, I need to thank our key holders. They're doing their part to keep the Meat House podcast free. You too can join up for as little as $2 a month, and you'll get some cool rewards and keyholder-only content. Just search the Meat House over at patreon.com, or you can follow the link in the show notes. So, what are we drinking tonight? As usual, I have two glasses in front of me. The first one, which is not germane to our discussion here, is this is a product from Boulevard. I was talking about them on the last show here, too. And we went to the tasting room for Father's Day. And on the way out, I saw this one for sale in four packs, and it looked intriguing. This is Smooth Collider. It's a smoothie sour with strawberry, banana, and vanilla flavors. Yeah, and that pretty much calls it. It is, there's strawberry, banana there. There is a sourness to it that's tart. It has lemony, orangey kind of a flavor to it. I'm not sure if it's an additional fruit juice that they're not talking about, or if that's, you know, the product of a like a bacterial souring or anything like that. There's so much fruit going on in this that it's a little hard to pin down, but it is very smooth, very drinkable. And I just finished mowing the lawn about an hour ago, so this is really hitting the spot. Moving on to my second glass, though, I was lucky enough to get the spare bottle from our Iron Bee main ingredient competition here. And this is Tea Time with Blueberries, brewed by our guest tonight, Kyle. This is the first time I'm getting to try it at all. And just from the scent, there is a great blueberry aroma off this, a little bit of honey. Blueberry is, you know, the kind of the dominant flavor there, although the honey is it's also there as well. I mean, the secret ingredient, which was passion flower, is it's kind of playing a secondary or tertiary note there. Which is kind of the way you had to approach it, because it is a little bit of an oddball and a little bit of a challenge, if I do say so myself. But it does add a kind of an herbaceous note to it that is really nice. So, Kyle, what is in your glass tonight?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. So I have, in classic Meat House fashion, I have two glasses going tonight, and I have my first offering is from Tap House. It's experiment number 2106, apple and hibiscus. It's a golden off-red color. It's the apple presentation is really nice on it. The hibiscus is definitely on the lower end of expression, but it definitely gives like almost a kind of a red delicious skin quality. Mm-hmm. That's really nice. It's has a little bit of like a caramel kind of apple character from some of the honey notes I'm picking up. It's really complex and interesting, and it's not like any other sizer I've had.
I actually happen to have the bottle of that in front of me here. That was a strong contender for my other drink tonight. And I'm just looking at it from curiosity. I'm not seeing what kind of honey they used in it, but I would be curious to know. So, yeah, no, and apple and hibiscus go together great. I am curious to crack this open, and we'll probably be talking about that on another episode here soon. So how about your other glass?
My other glass is the Tea Time with Blueberries as well. I just had one bottle left too. It was a little 6-ouncer. A lot of my friends really loved it, and it was one of those situations where I just made a small batch because I wasn't too confident on how the secret ingredient was going to play out with passion flowers. So I didn't want to make a 5-gallon batch, but I kind of wish I did now.
Well, you know, the beauty of bead making is you can always take your recipe and repeat the batch too. So let's talk about the passion flower. This was, admittedly, this was a challenging ingredient because it, a lot of people gave me some flack for the selection because it brings up those notes of like fresh cut grass or hay or alfalfa. What was your initial reaction to it, and how did you kind of approach using this in a mead?
Yeah, so when I got the 4-ounce bag of lawn clippings, you're talking about mowing the lawn earlier. I was really perplexed. I just smelled it right out of the bag, and I still couldn't quite grasp what I was going to do with it. So what I did was, as has been suggested on the show before and other mead avenues, is to make a tea out of it just to get familiar. So I made a pretty, I would say a moderate strength tea, nothing like too crazy, but I just took, I have like these, reusable tea bags. So I just put some in there and then steeped it for a few minutes and then added a little bit of honey because, it gave me an idea of where I wanted to go with the mead overall. That's a trick I've been doing lately, is watering down some honey to get like a more balanced honey tasting. It's a little overwhelming on the palate just to like take a glob of honey and put it on your tongue. So putting it in some tea, putting in some more balanced environments where there's a little bit of tannin, maybe just a watered down kind of scenario, gives a better presentation. So with this scenario, with this, I was picking up a lot of that kind of grassy, herbaceous, earthy. There was like a hint of like sweet hay. And I was still perplexed after doing that. And it was a fruitful exercise, but at the same time, I was still stumped. So I looked online to see, all right, what is this stuff used for? Like, there's obviously a purpose. It's being sold. It's being consumed. Mound Rose Herbs obviously has a market for it. So what's the deal? So I looked it up, and usually it's used in like a sleepy time kind of blend with chamomile and maybe some other relaxing, herbs and, to make a sleepy time kind of blend for tea. So what I decided is, all right, I want to do chamomile because that's a more like approachable flavor. And then I was thinking, what like pairs this sweetness of the honey, the kind of earthy, grassy, herbal note from the chamomile and the passion flower? And I was thinking blueberries, because blueberries have like their skin is on the earthier side, but they have like this really nice floral component. And they're not as assertive as some other berries like black currants or raspberries or blackberries. So I figured it would be a nice medium for the overall bridge between honey and the passion flower.
And so how did you go about incorporating blueberries into the mead? Were you using whole fruit or capure? And, you know, if whole fruit was the answer, kind of like what was your ratio for pounds per gallon, so to speak?
Yeah, so another thing I did was I also added lemon zest to the scenario to bring out the brightness as well, but it's like very very low on the spectrum. But what I did to start out is I knew this challenge was going to happen, And I wanted something that was pretty clean and fermented smoothly. So what I did is I just made a 12% base of, it was sweet clover, sweet Dakota clover honey.
Mm-hmm.
And I used Kvike Voss and just fermented really hot. And that gave me a good base to meet any timeline, essentially.
Right.
So from there, as soon as I got the ingredient, and then I was figuring, okay, what fruit am I going to put with it? What's my overall balance? Then I was able to take, I took 4 pounds of blueberries for that gallon, and mm-hmm. I had it in a bucket, and I added Lauzyme, EXV, just an enzyme that would break down the fruit a little better, and I just let that, I had the berries were frozen, and then I just right. thawed them with the enzyme, and then I just racked the meat on top of it. The meat was not finished. It was like not clear. It was okay. not stabilized yet. So I did get a little dilution from that. I think it made it around like 9-10% instead of 12. And then so
would you say it was like to the tail end of primary? Would you say it was in the secondary? How old was the meat at that point?
The meat was about 10 days old, but it was done fermenting. It was where I was. Like it was done fermenting within 48 hours. It's one of those things where maybe it had like 5 to 10 gravity points left, but if you really crank the Kvike, it's pretty amazing. Lately I've been pitching at like 95 degrees, and then just wrapping it in ski pants. Like it's quite the image, yeah.
That's great, though. And no, I definitely appreciate the fast and efficient and amazing like flavor we get out of these Kvike strains. Voss is a personal favorite of mine as well.
Yeah, so I took took that almost finished mead. It basically, in a normal situation, I would wait a little bit longer to let it clear. I usually like, I want it mostly clear before I rack it. I'm not too worried about autolysis and my batches. I don't wait too long either. Especially with like a little bit of bentonite in primary, like
mm-hmm.
there's clarity can be had pretty quickly. But it's kind of like that polish doesn't happen yet. So this was like right before things were starting to drop. So yeah, I racked it on that four pounds of blueberries. It started fermenting again. Once it stopped, I racked off the blueberries. It was probably on the blueberries for 2 to 3 weeks. I would okay. say probably closer to two, just because I wanted to focus on a little bit of clarity too. And I got makes a sense. Lot of extraction from using the enzyme. And so what I did is I racked and then I stabilized. And from there I had this blueberry base. And then I added, I just made a giant tea, like a really concentrated tea,
mm-hmm.
where I took like an ounce of the elder, the passion flower, and I took a couple, I think it was 2 lemons worth of zest, and then it was 7 chamomile tea bags. And I just made this really concentrated liquid. Probably it was like a cup at the end. So just very packed full of flavor. And I didn't want to dilute the mead too much either.
Right.
So that's a trick I've been doing lately is like the other day I just did a ginger addition where I basically steeped a bunch of ginger like that. But anyway, having this really concentrated liquid, I was able to then almost use it as a tincture. It's not a tincture because it's not extracted alcohol, from alcohol, right. but
mm-hmm.
In a similar kind of sense where I was able to kind of tailor the dose. And I'm like, you know what? this is a passion flower challenge. Like, I want it to be showcased, but I don't want it to be like, I don't want this to be drinking grass. So I didn't want to like shy away from it either. So it's definitely faded a bit from where it was in terms of like the expression of passion flower. But at the same time, I enjoy it more now than I did because it there's like a blending of all of the layers and components where it's, yeah, it has like this herbal and like there's a little hay quality, but there's the blueberry really comes out. There's some citrus notes. There's like this, it's just more rounded and smooth. And that's a great part about mead making in general is the changing of the mead over time. And I think if this was like a stronger mead in terms of alcohol, it probably would have not changed as much. But at the same time, like I wanted something drinkable relatively quickly. I wasn't entirely sure of the deadlines and whatnot. And I wanted to put every tool in my basket. I wanted to use all of them.
Yeah. No, what you've come up with is a very drinkable, very delightful mead. And it is. I'm thoroughly enjoying this class here tonight. So, let's see. Okay, go ahead.
To be honest, like this competition was one of my favorite mead making experiences. They remind me of Chopped. It reminded me of all those shows I was watching on Food Network competitions. Mm-hmm. What's under the cloche? Like, let's figure this out and come up with something zany and fun. And it was cool hearing in that after show about what people came up with and some of the presentations. It was cool to also hear that the second place person also used blueberries. So I wasn't like, you know, just pulling something out of my butt. It was a combination that was thought of by more than one person, which is cool.
It is funny how often blueberries come up in this competition too, because we had our first year of this, we had a the name of it is escaping me. Jeff, you haven't drank this much yet. But
that one the of the MVP dom- here was that the fenugreek?
Fenugreek, thank you. We had fenugreek, and I think a lot of people kind of glommed onto the idea that it has a maple syrup character to it. And so we had a lot of people that were going for the blueberry pancakes angle there, which is not a terrible idea at all. But it's funny how pervasive the idea of blueberries has become in Iron Bee. But yeah, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, those Food Network shows, because that's actually kind of the genesis of the idea when the three of us were talking about it years and years ago. JD mentioned he wanted to do some kind of a competition, but he wanted to do it different, like with a secret ingredient or something like that. And the first thing that came to mind was Iron Chef. And that was the whole thing. He was like, okay, we're going to send you a secret ingredient. It's going to be called the Iron Bee. And that's pretty much it. It was Food Network shows that were the whole inspiration there.
It's super fun, and it's one of those things that is a great equalizer in terms of skill level. And because, you know, I would not assume other people have worked with passion flower, so it's a good way to assess ingredients and flavor combinations. And
yeah, I know of a couple of people that I've seen working with it on Facebook way back, but I think they were actually more interested in working with the fruit of the passion flower vine, which it's kind of like a passion fruit, but it's not exactly. It's something that would actually grow in, you know, my part of the country here in the Midwest. I think the person I was talking to was in Oklahoma or Arkansas growing it like in his backyard. And the idea intrigued me a lot. So when this came up as an option, it was like I kind of glommed onto it and went, that's weird and different, and we need to play with that. Not to completely switch gears here, but you have been busy in the last 6 months. I've seen a bunch of posts from you online. I think I saw, was it last week or the week before, you were on our friend Man-Made Meat show talking about a Lactomel you made. Tell us about some of the fun stuff that you've been doing in the last 6 months, Kyle.
Yeah, so I emptied my barrel that I talked about the last time I was on here. And what I did with that, it was a 15% sweet wildflower traditional that was aged in a gin barrel. So, and mm-hmm. I had 30 gallons of it. So having 30 gallons of one mead is, as a homemade maker, is a little boring unless it's like phenomenal. This mead was good, but I knew that I wanted to split it up. So what I've done is I made like, so I just racked it into different carboys. And one was a, one batch was a Lapsang Souchong with pasilla and chipotle pepper.
Interesting. Now, the Lapsang Souchong, is that, that's the smoky kind of tea, right?
Yeah. So this mead, and I used a tincture of, I used 6 ounces of the tea with just enough scotch to kind of get it wet. And then I just squeezed that scotch tea liquid out. Nice. So it presents to me almost as a, where scotch meets mole. It's really fun.
Interesting. And
it's like the perfect taco drinking mead.
Like it just, I can see that. Yeah.
The other one I did was a juniper berry with orange zest and coriander. I didn't leave the juniper in long enough, I don't think, but I was a little gun shy about that. So it presented more of the, like the floral citrusy side instead of like the cedary, like woody side. I just don't think there's enough time for extraction, but it still was really nice. And then I did a walnut and fig mead from there. And now I have a batch of ginger mead where I took, it was 4 pounds of ginger and I chopped it up and I steeped it in hot water for 4 hours or so. And then I got like this really concentrated liquid that I then added to the mead. I also added some lemon zest and lemon juice to that too, just to brighten it up a bit. And usually lemon is paired with ginger anyway. So,
right. Now that, that 4 pounds of ginger that you made into a concentrate, what size of a batch was that going into? What that you split from?
Yeah. So that was in, 6.5 gallons. Yeah, the ginger wasn't like the freshest stuff. It's from Vermont. So it's like, well, not from Vermont, but, you know, like from a Vermont grocery store where I picked it up. And I also used some candy ginger, too, partially for the microbial safety, where it has some preservatives on it. So that was helpful in terms of I added it to an already finished mead. So that was helpful. And I haven't tasted this iteration, but I can always add more. I think I might need to add more depending on how the flavors play. But that's my favorite part of mead making is you can always doctor things around and work on things. And you don't need to worry about oxidation as much as in beer. And it's just a blast.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, I was talking about the back sweetening and the kind of the flavoring part of my sangria meat on the last episode. Mm-hmm. And, oh, yeah, that last little bit where you're fine-tuning it and really making it shine, if you can make an evening of that over a couple hours, it is just such a treat to be able to just sit back and do that and have fun with it. Easily one of my favorite parts of the whole hobby. Of course, then comes bottling and...
Well, exactly.
You know.
Yeah. But yeah, those are some of the things I have going on. I've done some session meads lately. One of my cool ones that has been really fun is I joined a homebrew club and we did a Belgian Abbey Ale club brew. And I just grabbed a little bit for fermenting. And so I still had quite a bit of yeast left. So I took some spent cherries that I had from a big cherry bomb. And I took that with some Ule blossom honey, some buckwheat, some maple syrup, and made a session mead out of that fermenting with the Abbey Ale yeast. And it's a very cool session mead. It's dry, but it's very complex and a lot of different layers. The cherries were picked in Vermont. They're Balaton and another Morello type. So it's a very fun session mead that I don't think a lot of people have played around with using some of those Belgian yeast in that way or mixing honeys in that way. And just
now, how much yeast character presentation did you get with the session mead there? Was it like a strong, like you would get from a Belgian? Was it more subdued? How did you find that?
It was definitely more subdued than in a beer. But it did help with bridging the gap a little bit between the fruity side of the cherry and the more like earthy, funky side of buckwheat, essentially. So it was nice to have some spice character, but it was very low. It was not... It just added to the je ne sais quoi, the kind of a little final touch. I also did it just out of like... it was almost like throwing the kitchen sink in the fermenter because I had this extra yeast. I didn't want it to go bad. I had these extra honeys that were like leftovers from other things. And I had these spent cherries that I wanted to get a little more extraction out of. And so it was kind of a hodgepodge, but also like I thought about it a little bit.
No, and some of those experiments can be some of the most fun, too. I mean, that sounds a little bit like one of Ryan's classic pantry clean-out meads, except maybe with a little bit more, a little bit more thought and, you know, not so much this is what I have lying around, but, you know, I have this. What can I combine it with? Oh, this and that. And that'd be good, too.
Yeah, exactly. I have one of the things that I'm about to start is one of the main reasons I make mead is for my both expression of my artistic abilities, and it's just a really fun hobby, but also to share special moments with my family and friends. And my little brother recently got engaged, and they both asked me for a wedding mead, so kind of a his and hers mead. And so she wants a peach mango mead after doing some tastings of some of my stuff I've made. And then I just told them the caveat is they just need to be able to be blended together in a glass, which is not too hard to do. You can almost blend any flavor together. But he decided he wanted a raspberry mead, especially after I made a raspberry chocolate mead for my sister's wedding last year. So like, these kind of moments in a mead maker's arsenal is the best. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
I was lucky enough, and it was, man, it was early enough in my career. I think it was even before I was on the podcast, but I brewed a couple different meads for my wedding, and man, of course, it was a happy day. It was a big celebration, but like getting sidelined while I was wandering around or like trying to get seconds for dinner. And Jeff, your mead is excellent. Thank you so much. This is great. Like it was just that little cherry on top that made that day even better.
Yeah. Now you're giving me ideas for when I tie the knot.
Give yourself plenty of time to do it, because tell you what, I tried bottling a mead that was not quite finished, and it was great on the day, but I took two bottles home because they were all that was left of a 6-gallon batch, and they apparently just sitting out in the hot day from the wedding, they got very carbonated very quickly.
Oh, classic, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this barrel project that I'm having, it's a really fun one. And last time I talked about it, I was talking about a sizer I was going to put in there. And I put a sizer in there, and I'm going to empty it probably in March of next year. I gotta do my quarterly tasting and give it a judgment. But
sure.
My plan is to make a Dwolniak, the Polish mead that's one part water to one part honey. Mm-hmm. I call it my Vermontniak, which is a maple buckwheat Dwolniak, and
that's a great name.
Calculation for the sugar ratios, because maple syrup is about 66% sugar versus honey, which is closer to 81-82. Mm-hmm. So I just do a little math there, but it's the mead I have is super good. It obviously needs a lot of age, but it's one of those things where just having that base, I'm super excited to throw that in a barrel, and especially when it's more neutral and I get some of that micro oxidation. And but I'm going to be picking a bunch of black currants from a friend's farm, and going to add that to the mix to make a really awesome 30-gallon batch of Dwolniak. And that's going to be one I will cellar for a very long time.
Very nice. Now, that was you're working with a 30-gallon barrel, you said?
Yeah.
How long do you think you're going to let it kind of chill in the barrel, anticipating-wise? I'm obviously tasting and seeing, but what's your expectation there for timeline?
Yeah, my expectation's around 3 years. But it's one of those things where I will definitely need to do it as I go, because I don't have a lot of experiences to work off, and other people I don't know a lot of people that have done it off the top of my head. I definitely know there's some Polish folks that have barrels on barrels and barrels, and they do the same kind of stuff. But at the same time, it's going to be for me and my loved ones. So I'm going to just taste it as I go. But I'm assuming at least, like, it's probably going to be at least a year and a half. 3 years is probably when I'm going to pull it, but we'll see.
Yeah. You know, obviously you've got to play it by ear and kind of see how it's going. That is a very exciting project. I have not been brave enough to put something away for nearly that length of time. I love the idea of doing this one of those long age Polish ones. Especially now that I've got a little more space to work with in my brew room here.
Yeah, absolutely. Your sangria mead that you talked about last week, that made me think about just a bunch of things that we're talking about on some of the Discords I'm a part of. And there's one where it's on the Man-Made Mead Discord, and we're talking about kind of emulating cocktails and doing that in mead form. And it's very interesting to be like, well, yeah, you're going to get this character out of this ingredient, but it's going to be different because in the way they make it through a spirit, it's extracted differently. So the flavor is going to be a little different. So you need to like make it up for that. It almost reminds me of kind of those virgin cocktails where they need to add a little something to make it taste a little bit like alcohol.
Right.
It's not going to be the same thing. Like with my juniper berries, there's no way that's going to taste like gin exactly. Because for, like having juniper, yeah, it's great, but in the distillation process, it goes through very high temperatures and really high octane alcohol. And there's like a little basket that they put through the still in that, mm-hmm. in that extraction method. And you can't really replicate that just by throwing juniper in a mead. So partially, I think it's like, okay, let's choose the right honey. Let's choose like maybe this other bittering agent that will add this complexity. And it's just very, really neat to think of, because it's like, all right, I could just go out and get the spirits and aperitifs for whatever cocktail I want. But to say, oh, I made this with this intention and it came out this way out of a mead is really something else.
Yeah, I could see that. And like you said, there are so many different approaches to this, and I think that's part of the fun of this, is just kind of trying things out and fiddling to try and see what you can emulate. I mean, the idea of a cocktail mead is also just a fun idea to play with, because the kind of cocktails that come into fashion are, you know, different year to year and decade to decade. So, you know, was it last year or the year before, the Aperol Spritz was a popular cocktail. And the idea of getting something that bitter and orange kind of flavor into a mead without other off flavors involved in it kind of was a fascinating challenge that I never took up but thought about a couple times. So, I can definitely appreciate that line of thought and inquiry there. Jeez. So, let's see, closing this out. The big question we always like to ask, what is your advice for new or beginning mead makers? Like, what are some of the lessons you've learned that have been really helpful for you there, Kyle?
Yeah, that's a great one. I think a really big thing that has leveled my game up a lot has been intentionally to taste your mead in a way that it's just trying to use as many descriptors as possible, whether it's looking at a flavor wheel from some of the online sources out there. Like there's the Mead Institute's coming up, a lot of really cool work around that. Doing that with a friend that you think has an eye for flavor, and maybe they're a really good taster of wine or beer, or even that maybe they're a mead maker, maybe they're a part of your homebrew club. I highly advise joining a homebrew club too, but I think just intentional tasting of your mead, and that will make you go from just thinking about like fermenting cleanly and getting past that section into flavor development, into balancing, into kind of the more technical work. So I think that's what makes that's what I wish I knew more of as a beginner mead maker, is the intentional tasting.
And I think that's great advice, you know, to take some time to really just think through what you're tasting and what you're experiencing when you drink a mead. It's not exactly something that is, it's not the first thing that people think about when they put an alcoholic beverage in their mouth, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think a lot of it is also like, I think we all need to practice it as much as possible anyway. So it's like, if you can start early and start thinking critically like that, then you're going to be more prone to the learning of, okay, this is an off flavor, or, oh, this is something I learned from when I was beginning, and now I'm not going to ferment orange this way. I'm not going to use these types of cherries this way. Like, I think it's just, it's part of being like a reflective learner in general.
I think that's great advice. And yeah, taking some time to be intentional and thoughtful with your process and your tasting is definitely a strong component. And speaking as a mead judge, I can definitely say that that's it's an important part of just developing your palate, so to speak, and being able to taste and kind of feel what, you know, what this is, what that is this something I enjoy, and what flavor am I experiencing here? Is this, you know, is this a fruit? Is this an off flavor? Is this kind of weird taste good, or is it bad, or does it mesh with everything else? There's a lot of different components that can go into it in any given situation, but yeah, being intentional with your tasting is, I think, a great piece of advice. So, Kyle, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me, chat for a little bit. I really appreciate it. And for you guys listening at home, thank you for tuning in to tonight's episode. We will be back next week with episode 222. Feel free to drop me a line on Facebook, on Reddit, or info@themeathouse.com. Until then, you know, it's time for me to wipe down the bar, get the chickens back in the coop. So until next time, friends, good night.